the little girl in his Harvard-educated diction. "What do you mean, both of you?"
"Well, we knew you were coming," she explained, "but we didn't know you'd be traveling together."
Since Scott hadn't known any of his father's life since his mother hightailed it to Boston, save for the fact he owned a cattle empire, he was a little slow to pick up the little girl's implication. "You were expecting both of us," pointing to the man at his side in the red ruffled shirt.
"Yeah," she said happily. "You're Johnny," pointing her finger at the dark-haired one in the red ruffles. "And you're Scott," moving her finger in the direction of the blonde man in blue.
Well, that was their names. The two men shared another uneasy look at the other as the reality of the situation became obvious. Johnny pointed his finger at the pint-sized provocateur and asked, "And who are you?"
"I'm Mirabella Lancer, and you're my brothers." And with that declaration, she charged like a runaway wagon at Johnny, wrapping her little arms around his waist and knocking him back on the heels of his cowboy boots.
A look of dread crossed the face of Johnny Lancer. He'd contemplated many variables when he'd imagined the moment he would be reunited with his father. But an apple-cheeked, ecstatic 8-year-old half-sister wasn't one of them. Before Scott could inquire about the meaning of all this, Mirabella had untangled herself from Johnny and had now wrapped her arms around Scott, squeezing his pelvic area, surprisingly strong for such a small fry, trying to maintain some decorum and hold off, if only for a few seconds more, the inevitable conclusion of her revelation. Scott said, "Look, little girl." Mirabella interrupted him by clarifying her name a second time.
"Mirabella."
"Mirabella," he continued, "my mother never had any other children."
"Nope," Johnny said, pointing out the obvious, "but apparently your father did."
Scott turned toward Johnny and said, "You mean our father?" Johnny answered,
"Yeah, our father, Murdoch Lancer. Look, I don't know why you made the trip, Top Hat, but the old man said he'd give me $1,000 if I came to see him."
"He made the same offer to me," Scott confirmed.
"I want that $1,000, Johnny said. "And after I get it, I'm going to give him a bellyful."
A bellyful of what? Johnny left unspoken. Apparently, Scott had the same idea.
"You and me both, brother."
Johnny shook his head. "Don't call me brother."
"Are you ready to go?"
Mirabella interjected pleasantly. They both turned to her and said in unison, "Go where?" Which annoyed both of them, and they gave a dirty look to each other. But their little sister thought it was funny, and she giggled out loud.
"Where do you think? Lancer Ranch, you silly goose!"
Mirabella turned on her heels, and she and the vaquero Ernesto led the way down the street toward the wagon that Ernesto had driven 10 miles into town. Scott hooked the handle of his silver dog-headed cane through the hardwood handle of his valise and lifted it up to his free hand, while Johnny pitched the saddle over his shoulder. The two brothers followed their sister, who proceeded to paint a picture of what they could expect when they met their father.
"Now, Daddy won't act like it at first," she warned them. "And he can be a bit of a mule head, but no matter what he says, he's happy both of you came."
Johnny snorted sarcastically. "Yeah, well, we'll see if he still feels that way after a little family reunion."
As Scott limped beside him, he concurred. "You know, brother, that's the first thing you said I agree with."
That fucking did it, Johnny thought,
and stopped in his tracks, pointing his finger in Scott's baby blue chest.
"I done told you, don't call me brother, Top Hat."
Scott's eyes went down to the aggressive finger, then rose up to the aggressive face, and he warned, "Don't point your finger at me, Ruffles."
"Boys?"
The two brothers turned away from each other toward their little sister as she gestured toward the wagon and asked condescendingly,
Can we go?
The two men gave each other a look that suggested to be continued. But for the sake of this little sweetheart, they dropped their fighting stance. And Johnny gestured toward the wagon.
Lead the way, sis.
Chapter 9. Think less hippie, more Hell's Angels. Cliff drives Rick's Cadillac past the front gate on the 20th Century Fox lot. The guard at the gate gives him directions to the Spanish Western town back lot where the Lancer pilot is being shot. Drive straight to the second left, make a turn at Tyrone Power Boulevard, drive past the man-made lake and the set of Hello Dolly, turn right on Linda Darnell Avenue and you can't miss it. In the passenger seat next to him, Rick wears big, dark glasses to shield his eyes from the sun and smokes down a capital W cigarette to shield his tongue from taste. When Cliff jerks the car to a stop, Rick knows they have arrived. The actor glances out the passenger side window, and through his dark glasses he sees a western town. A few horses and wagons, film crew, some asshole director perched on top of a Chapman crane. A cowboy actor who obviously thinks he's sexy, dressed in a bright red Las Vegas-style shirt and a short brown cowboy hat. Some comically dressed, fancy-pants dude in a bright blue three-piece suit complete with a top hat that looks like he drifted over from the set of Meet Me in St. Louis. Period dress little girl. And a Mexican runt in a large sombrero. Welcome to fucking Lancer, Rick thinks. He opens the car door and steps out from the vehicle on shaky legs. Upon standing upright, he's struck by a coughing fit that brings up some stomach acid to the back of his esophagus. He spits out a green loogie mixed with red and turns back to Cliff behind the wheel. The actor leans down and talks to his assistant through the open passenger window.
I think the wind blew down my TV antenna last night. You think you mind going home and fixing it?
I can and I will, Cliff assures him.
Then, asking Rick as nonchalantly as he can, could you talk to the stunt gaffer about me today?
That way I know if I'm working this week or not.
There was a time when Cliff's involvement on one of Rick's projects was contractually negotiated. If Rick was playing the role, then Cliff was doubling him. On the Universal Films, it was negotiated into Rick's contract, and there was a chair on the set with Cliff's name on it. But it ain't been that time in a long time. Now that Rick is guesting on other people's television shows, Cliff isn't guaranteed jack shit. Most TV show stunt gaffers had their own crew, and most TV show stunt gaffers' first priority was looking after their crew. If Cliff was going to get a couple of days on Tarzan or Bingo Martin, it was because Rick had had a word with the stunt gaffer and talked him into it. Rick sighs.
Yeah, I've been meaning to tell you.
Avoid it was closer to the truth. The guy who gaffs the show is best friends with Randy. You know, the gaffer from The Green Hornet.
Knowing what that means, Cliff says. Fuck.
So there really ain't no point,
Rick says pragmatically. Cliff curses bitterly.
That fucking little nip.
Then he turns his bitterness onto himself.
Why do I care if the Green Hornet's fucking chauffeur thinks he can wipe Allie's ass? I mean, Jesus fucking Christ. Heavyweight champion of the world needs me to fucking defend him? Especially at the expense of your career and my fucking reputation, Rick adds, getting irritated all over again. I practically had to suck Randy's cock to get you that gig. Rick remembers. And what do? You practically break that little big mouth's back. End result, you get blackballed from 3/4 of the shows in town and I look like a fucking asshole. But you showed him, Rick finishes sarcastically.
Look, man. The stuntman raises his palms flat out in surrender. When you're right, you're right, and you're right.
Rick tells Cliff an old acting story. Oblivious to the fact that he's told Cliff this exact same story 3 times before. Listening to Rick tell the same stories and anecdotes, pretending to be unaware of the repetition, is practically part of Cliff's job description. And to be ungenerous, a sign of Rick's low intelligence.
"I'm doing my first decent part in a feature," Rick begins. "Battle of the Coral Sea with Cliff Robertson, directed by Paul Wencos. I'm doing one of my first real parts for the guy who's gonna turn out being my favorite director in a real studio movie, Columbia Pictures. A Columbia B movie, but still not Republic, not AIP, fucking Columbia Pictures."
Cliff looks up from the driver's seat at his boss, settling himself in to hear the same story for the fourth time.
"So anyway, I'm excited as all fucking hell. Except there's this fucking second AD on the picture, who's a real horse's ass.
And this fucker is fucking with me the whole time.
Not Tommy Laughlin. Definitely not Cliff Robertson. He's practically sucking Cliff's cock. He's not fucking with anybody else, just me."
Rick continues. "It's shitty. It's unfair. And finally, I fucking had it.
So I'm having lunch with this chubby guy on the movie, a William Whitney regular, Gordon Jones. Been around a real long time. Been in 80 fucking movies. Real good cat. So I tell Jones, I'm waiting for this fucking prick to say one more word to me. Just one more fucking word. I'm gonna fucking lay him out."
Now Rick gets to the moral of the story.
"And Jones tells me, yeah, you could do that. And yeah, you could probably take him. And yeah, he deserves it. But before you lay him out on the job, take your SAG card out of your wallet, light a match, and set it on fire. Because since basically, that's what you'll be doing, you might as well go all the way."
Cliff repeats the sentiment from before.
"I get it. I get it. Who fucking cares what that little prick says? I'm in Jesus Christ on a fucking crutch," Rick says. "If every time a series lead made a big claim about something they obviously couldn't do, somebody took a poke at them, no work would ever get done. Bob Conrad and Darren McGavin wouldn't be able to get through a fucking week without some wrangler braining them," Rick illustrates. "That midget playing Cato, he's a fucking actor. Any actor claiming to do anything except saying lines other people wrote is full of fucking shit. And most of them can't even fucking do that."
Rick counts off on his fingers the actors who know what they're talking about.
"You want to talk to Audie Murphy about killing dudes? He could tell you. You want to talk to Jim Brown about running touchdowns? He could tell you. You want to talk to Sonya Henning about ice skating? She could tell you. You want to talk to Esther Williams about fucking swimming? Go ahead. But everybody else is fucking faking it. And if anybody should fucking know that, it's a goddamn war hero stuntman."
Cliff smiles up at his boss and repeats in a zen-like manner,
"Like I said, when you're right, you're right." "Darn tootin', I'm right," Rick says.
Changing the subject, Cliff asks,
"Well, if you don't need me for anything else, I'll just pick you up at rep."
"Nah," Rick confirms.
"Just see what you can do about that damn antenna, and I'll see you at rep."
Then Rick asks, "When's rep today?"
7:30,
Cliff says.
"See you then."
And Rick walks off toward the Lancer set. Then after a moment, Cliff calls out to him. Rick turns around, and from behind the wheel of the Cadillac, his buddy points a strong finger at him and says,
"Just remember, you're Rick fucking Dalton. Don't you forget that."
That makes the actor smile. He gives his buddy a little salute. Then the Coupe de Ville drives away, and the actor reports for work. Sitting in the chair in front of a vanity mirror in the Lancer makeup trailer, Rick dunks his face in a bowl of ice water. Supposedly, Paul Newman does this every morning. But for Newman, it's part of his beauty regime. For Rick, it's to stimulate his senses out of the queasy numbness of last night's alcohol. When his face emerges from the freezing water, he takes a couple of cubes in his hands and rubs them across his face and on the back of his neck. Sonia, the makeup and hair girl on this pilot, who supplied Rick with the bowl of ice water, sits in a makeup chair three stations away, smoking a Chesterfield. Sitting in the chair next to her, waiting for the director to arrive so they can discuss Rick's costume, is the show's fleshy, big-haired cutie pie costume designer, Rebecca. If she were wearing pigtails, the outfit she has on could nab her third prize in a Wednesday Addams look-alike contest. Over the Wednesday Addams outfit, she wears a big Wild Ones-like leather motorcycle jacket. While Sonia doesn't let on, she clearly knows the difference between a beauty ritual, Paul Newman be damned, and a hangover assistance. For one, there's less moaning in a beauty ritual. Just as the ice-cold stimulation is starting to penetrate Rick's face, the door to the makeup trailer flies open, banging against the back wall, and the director of the Lancer pilot steps into the trailer with a huge theatrical flamboyance that is his customary method of entering a room. Greeting Rick as if he were projecting to the back row of the old Vic, the director announces, "Rick Dalton, Sam Wanamaker." The director shoots his hand out to the seated, slightly discombobulated, wet-faced actor, who instinctively completes the handshake greeting with a dripping wet paw. Clearing his voice, Rick sputters, "Good to meet ya, Sam, sorry about the wet hand." Sam dismisses the wet hand comment. "No worries, I'm used to it with Yul," referencing the exotic Hollywood movie star Yul Brynner, who Wanamaker became friends with when the two acted together in the historical action picture, Taras Bulba. Recently, Yul Brynner had backed Wanamaker's move behind the camera by starring in Sam's first feature, The File of the Golden Goose. Wanamaker continues with Dalton, "I want you to know, Rick, I'm the one who cast you, and I couldn't be more thrilled about you doing this." The director is dealing with Rick with a tank of high octane, while the quart-low actor is struggling to catch his equilibrium. Rick's nerves kick in, and his slight stammer starts making its first appearance of the day. "Well, thanks, Sam. I appreciate it." Then finally getting hold of the sentence, "It's a good part." "Have you met the series lead, Jim Stacy?" Wanamaker asks, referring to the actor playing the role of Johnny Lancer. "Not yet," Rick stutters. "Does this fucking guy stutter?" Sam thinks. "You guys are gonna be dynamite together," Sam says. "Well," Rick looks for the right word, then gives up and just says, "That sounds exciting." Wanamaker says confidentially, even though Sonia and Rebecca can hear everything he's saying, "Just between you and me, the network casts the series leads, Jim and Wayne." Wayne is the series co-lead, Wayne Maunder, who plays the Boston-raised Lancer brother, Scott. "And they did a fine job, but nevertheless, the network chose them, but I chose you. Primarily because I can foresee possible guerrilla magic between you and Stacy, and I want you to exploit that." Sam leans over Rick, the massive gold zodiac medallion, Gemini, the director wears around his neck, swinging in the air back and forth over Rick in the makeup chair. "That doesn't mean I want you to be anything less than professional, but you're the seasoned pro. I want to work with you," pointing a finger down at Rick, "to help me get what I need out of him," jerking his thumb over his shoulder at Stacy somewhere outside the makeup trailer. "When the two of you are in costume, I want you," again pointing down at Rick in his chair,
to subtextually keep the cock-measuring contest continuing between the two of you. Waving his hands in front of him in order to frame a picture in the air for Dalton to imagine, think of a confrontation between a silverback gorilla and a Kodiak bear.
Rick chuckles. Well, Sam, that's some image.
Wanamaker agrees.
I know.
Which one am I? Rick asks. The gorilla or the bear?
Which one has the biggest cock?
Wanamaker answers.
Well, Dalton deduces, that would probably be the gorilla.
Have you ever seen a fully erect Kodiak bear?
Wanamaker challenges.
I can't say I have,
Dalton confides.
Then don't be so sure, Wanamaker warns.
When the two of you are in scenes, Wanamaker directs, I want you to goad him.
You think it can do that, Rick? What do you mean, goad him?
Dalton asks.
Goad him, Wanamaker repeats. Poke the bear. Get his dander up. You goad him as if you are trying to convince the network executives to fire Stacy and reshoot the pilot with you as Johnny Lancer. You goad him like that, Wanamaker assures Dalton. You'll be doing both him and the show a favor. Not to mention capturing lightning in a bottle.
Wanamaker finds Sonia behind him in the reflection in the mirror, sitting in her chair, smoking her Chesterfield. He doesn't turn to address her. He just speaks to her reflection.
Sonia, he dictates, first off, I want to give Caleb a mustache. A big, long, droopy, Zapata-like mustache. Oh, great, Rick thinks. He hates fake beards and mustaches. It's like trying to act with a caterpillar glued to your upper lip and a beaver attached to your face. Not to mention he hates spirit gum slathered on his mug. After Wanamaker mentions the Zapata-like mustache, the director bursts out laughing and tells Rick, and trust me, when Stacy gets a look at that goddamn mustache, he's gonna flip his fucking wig. The director explains, we both wanted Johnny Lancer to have a mustache. I told the network we need facial hair like that to make the genre feel modern, like what the Italians are doing in Europe. Rick winces.
Wanamaker continues, too wrapped up in his story to clock Rick's reaction.
Well, CBS said no fucking way. You want to put a mustache on somebody, put it on the heavy.
And that means you, Rick, Sam says with a big grin. Rick doesn't dig wearing phony mustaches. But if the lead wants it and can't get it, but he can, that could be a horse of a different color.
So, Stacy wanted to wear a mustache? Rick confirms.
Wanamaker answers, yes.
Is that gonna bother Stacy? Rick asks.
Are you kidding? He's gonna go fucking apeshit. But he knows what the network said. So it'll just add another subtextual layer to the antagonism between you two.
Then he turns around and addresses Rebecca.
Now, Rebecca, darling, I want a different look for Rick's character, Caleb. I don't want him costumed like they costumed the heavies on Bonanza and the Big Valley for the last decade. I want a zeitgeist flair to the costume. Nothing anachronistic. But where does 1969 and 1889 meet? I want a costume he could wear into the London fog tonight and be the hippest guy in the place.
The counterculture-savvy costume designer gives the hip director the answer he wants. We got a custer jacket,
fringes all down the arm. It's tan now, but I dye it dark brown. He could hit the strip in it tonight. That's what Wanamaker wants to hear. He runs a finger down her cheek and says, "That's my girl." Rebecca smiles back, and at that moment, Rick knows Sam and Rebecca are fucking. Wanamaker spins back in Rick's directions. "Now, Rick, about your hair." A touch too defensively, Rick asks, "What about my hair?" Wanamaker answers back, "The Brill Cream boy generation is dead," Sam explains. "It's very Eisenhower. I want Caleb to have a different hairdo." "How different?" Rick asks. "Something more hippie-ish," Sam tells him. "You want me to look like some goddamn hippie?" Rick thinks. "You want me to look like a goddamn hippie?" Rick questions with a skeptical face. "Think less hippie," Sam clarifies. "More Hell's Angels." Sam's eyes find Sonia again in the reflection of the mirror. "I want to get an Indian wig, long hair, put it on his head, then cut it into a hippie hairstyle." Then quickly turning to Rick, "But scary hippie," he assures the actor. Rick interrupts Sam's creative flow with a question. Sam. Sam turns toward his actor, giving him his full attention. "Yes, Rick." Rick tries, without sounding like a temperamental horse's ass, to slow Sam's roll somewhat with a practical question. "Look, Sam, if you got my face covered up in all this, he searches for the right word, "junk, nobody's gonna know it's me." Sam Wanamaker takes a beat, then answers the actor, "Well, there are those, dear boy, that call that acting." Chapter 10. Misadventure. The minute Cliff shot his wife with a shark gun, he knew it was a bad idea. The impact hit her a little below the belly button, tearing her in half, both pieces hitting the deck of the boat with a splash. Cliff Booth had despised this woman for what seemed like years, but the moment he saw her ripped in two separate halves lying on the deck of his boat, years of ill will and resentment evaporated in an instant. He rushed to her side, cradling her, holding the two separate pieces of her torso together, expelling frantic, heartfelt statements of remorse and regret. He held her that way, keeping her alive, for 7 hours. He didn't risk leaving her side for 1 minute to call the Coast Guard for fear without his applied pressure she'd come apart. So for 7 hours he held her close and tight, cradling her, calming her down, keeping her alive. If he hadn't shot her in the first place, the effort would have been heroic. On the bloody deck of the boat he had named after her, Billy's boat, amongst the guts, blood, and intestines seeping out of Billy Booth, the husband and wife, on the brink of death, had the 7-hour conversation they could never have in life. So she wouldn't dwell on the extremity of her dilemma, he kept her talking. What did they talk about? Their love story. In those 7 hours, they recounted their whole life together. As a Coast Guard ship finally approached, somewhere around hour 6, the husband and wife were communicating in baby talk like two helplessly in love 14-year-olds away at summer camp, each trying to outdo the other in a game of remembering the smallest detail of their first meeting and first date. As the Coast Guard boarded the vessel and drove her into port, Cliff continued holding Billy's two separate halves together, all the while assuring her that she was going to be okay. "Hey, I ain't gonna lie," he said. "You're gonna have the King Kong of scars, but you're gonna be just fine.
Cliff tried so hard to convince Billy of this, that after 6 hours of committed line readings, he talked himself into it too.
So the pragmatic Cliff Booth was surprisingly surprised when in the Coast Guard's efforts to transfer Billy from the boat to the dock and an awaiting ambulance, she fell apart. Oh well. Inside the stunt community of Hollywood in the 60s, Cliff Booth was greatly admired for his distinguished military career and his status as one of World War II's great war heroes. But there existed widespread speculation that Cliff Booth murdered his wife and got away with it. No one really knew for sure if he shot her on purpose. It could have just been a tragic mishandling of diving equipment, which is what Cliff always claimed. But anybody who had ever seen a drunken Billy Booth berate Cliff in public in front of his colleagues didn't buy that. And since a lot of people in the Hollywood stunt community had seen that, they thought he just fucking killed her. Cliff even admitted to the authorities his wife had been drinking at the time of the accident. Since the authorities didn't know Billy, they didn't know what that meant. But stuntmen and their wives did. That probably meant Billy was being belligerent. And that probably meant she said one fucking thing too many. And that probably meant Cliff got fed up. And in a moment of weakness, he did something drastic. Something once he did, couldn't undo. How did Cliff get away with it? Easy. His story was plausible, and it couldn't be disproven. Cliff felt real bad about what he did to Billy, but as much regret and remorse as he felt, never occurred to him not to try to get away with murder. After all, Cliff had always been a practical what's-done-is-done type. While taking the whole matter seriously, he also observed it from a pragmatic point of view. He didn't need to spend 20 years in jail. Cliff could do an adequate job punishing himself for his reckless moment. After all, it wasn't like he was a criminal. It wasn't like he plotted her murder. It was practically the accident he claimed it was. When his finger pulled the trigger, was it a conscious decision? Not exactly. One, it was a hair trigger. Two, it was more instinct than a decision. Three, was it a pull, or was it closer to a twitch? Four, it wasn't like anybody was going to miss Billy Booth. She was a fucking cunt. Did she deserve to be ripped in two? Maybe not. But to say without Billy Booth on this earth, sweet life goes on unabated would be an understatement. Really, only her sister Natalie was upset, and she was even a bigger fucking cunt than Billy. And she was really only upset for a while. So Cliff carried the guilt, Cliff carried the remorse, and Cliff vowed to do better. What more does society want? The countless numbers of American soldiers he saved by killing Japs were definitely worth one Billy Booth. Now, the law enforcement agencies that investigated the case were not as aware of Cliff's violent tendencies as the Hollywood stunt community was. And Cliff's story of a tragic mishandling of diving equipment was very plausible. Also, as it turned out, proving exactly what happened when two people were alone in a boat out in the middle of the ocean wasn't so easy. The authorities had to prove it didn't happen the way Cliff said it did. So armed with a story that couldn't be disproven, Billy Booth's death was labeled misadventure. And from that day forward, Cliff became the most infamous man on any Hollywood set he set foot on. Because no matter what set he set foot on, he was always the only man on that set that everybody in the know knew got away with murder. Chapter 11, The Twinkie Truck. As Charles Manson negotiates the twisty roads leading up to Terry Melcher's house on Cielo Drive, in the beat-up Hostess Twinkie's Continental Bakery truck,
He knows he's taking a chance. When Charlie drove out from San Francisco to Los Angeles, it was with the purpose of getting his music published, his songs recorded with him singing them, landing a recording contract, and then finally becoming a rock and roll star. This whole being a spiritual leader to a bunch of zonked out kids and a guru to a harem of runaway girls was just supposed to be something he did in the meantime. And at first it worked. In fact, at first it worked really well. His girls led him to create a relationship with the Beach Boys drummer Dennis Wilson, a real honest-to-goodness rock star, which led Manson into a relationship with Wilson's friends, Greg Jacobson and Doris Day's son Terry Melcher. And that led to happenings, shindigs, toke parties, and jam sessions with other successful musicians on the L.A. rock music scene. Before Charlie knew it, he was sharing a joint with the lead singer of the Raiders, Mark Lindsay, hobnobbing with Mike Nesmith of the Monkees and Buffy St. Marie, and jamming on guitar with Neil Young. Neil fucking Young! Charlie not only jammed with him, his musical improvisational skills seriously impressed Young. That night, jamming with Neil Young was the closest to legitimacy Manson ever got. Charlie hoped his jam session with Young would lead to a meeting with Bob Dylan. But Bobby proved elusive. The closest Charlie ever got to meeting Dylan was trading a few words with Bob's sidekick at the time, Bobby Newirth, at the London Fog. No doubt about it, during the time when Charlie Manson and his family were hanging out at Dennis Wilson's pad, his musical aspirations had forward momentum. There was even a recording session where Charlie put some of his tunes down on 3/4-inch tape. It's doubtful that Melcher ever really entertained the idea of signing Charlie to Columbia Records, but it's not out of the realm of possibility that he entertained the idea of recording some of Charlie's songs for other artists. For all of Charlie's jailhouse wisdom and philosophical savvy, Manson was almost charmingly naive when it came to the music business. Charlie knew Terry Melcher was wishy-washy about his record-selling potential, but he never allowed himself to get discouraged by it. To an admirable degree, when it came to the subject of himself, Charlie was always the eternal optimist. A foot in the door was all he ever wanted, and a foot in the door is what he got when Terry Melcher assured him that, at some point, he would sit down and let Charlie play him some of his music on his guitar. Did Manson turn his relationship with Melcher into more than it was? Absolutely. Was Melcher somewhat intrigued by Charlie? Maybe. But Charlie's hottest prospect for gaining a record deal was his close relationship to Dennis Wilson. Dennis was the only real rock star of the Beach Boys. Brian was fat and getting fatter. Al Jardine looked like a skeleton, and Mike Love had been going bald since he was 18. Dennis was a sexy dreamboat, who even in the early 60s gave off a zen late 60s vibe. For a while, Dennis truly believed in Charlie's musical potential. He shared late-night trip sessions with Charlie, where Manson's philosophy and view of the world honestly impressed Dennis. Wilson also shared Manson's distrust and fear of black males. During jam sessions at his house, Dennis bore witness to Charlie's undeniable gift for in-the-moment improvisation behind a guitar. Still, it's dubious to think the untrained, undisciplined, loosey-goosey Manson would have ever gotten the hang of capturing his music in the pressure-filled, anxiety-inducing, sterile environment of a professional recording studio. In that regard, Charlie would have some serious musical genius company. Recordings of Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly serve more as historical records than as evocative representations of their musical talent. But it's not out of the question to imagine, in an earlier time, Charles Manson making his way and learning the ropes in the Pass the Hat Greenwich Village coffee house scene of the late 50s and early 60s, and on the Hootenanny circuit, where his gift for musical improvisation, skill with a guitar, and prison background would have all been assets. For a while, Dennis Wilson sincerely encouraged Charlie's musical dreams, even going so far as recording one of Charlie's songs, Cease to Exist, his signature family tune, rewritten under the title Never Learn Not to Love, and putting it on the Beach Boys' 2020 album. And while the idea of Terry Melcher signing Charlie to make an album for Columbia Records was always far-fetched, the Beach Boys started their own record label, Brother Records, and a Charles Manson album for that label could have happened. The reason it didn't all stemmed from the aggravation and eventual fear Dennis Wilson felt for the sketchy characters he let take root in his home. It was the girls that first lured Dennis into the family fold. Then later, it was his genuine fellowship with Charlie that kept Dennis in the family orbit. But it was Wilson's exasperation at Charlie's pinhead family of hippies that eventually led to burning the Beach Boys' bridge just as Charlie was preparing to cross it. The share and share alike anti-establishment ethos of the Topanga Canyon Hollywood hippie entertainment class of the late 60s was what Dennis Wilson offered these ragamuffins. However, pretty quickly, these garbage-eating, acid-tripping, clap-ridden, sing-song-sounding runaways proved themselves to be a bunch of freeloading ingrates. They wrecked Wilson's pad and cost him thousands of dollars in venereal disease medicine and lost, stolen, and damaged property. Until finally, Wilson just moved out of the house and left it to his business manager to evict the squalid squatters. If the family hadn't turned Dennis's house into a zoo, causing his bandmates to worry and lose respect for him, Charles Manson would have been a perfect prospect for the Beach Boys' new record label. One doubts much would have happened with the disc, or even if Manson, with his peculiarities, would have been capable of completing a full album. But it's entirely possible that, if the other band members hadn't associated Charlie with that group of freaks freeloading off of Sweet Dennis, Manson could have parlayed his association into something. But the way it was, the family cost Dennis so much money that even when the Beach Boys did record one of Charlie's songs, they kept his name off the publishing, figuring the costly antics of his acolytes were payment enough. Rumors exist that in lieu of putting Charlie's name on the copyright, Wilson gave him a motorcycle. So by February 8th, 1969, all of Charlie's once promising musical connections have dried up. Only one remains, that vague commitment that Terry Melcher once made about someday sitting down and letting Charlie play his music for him. Only he's lost contact with Terry. There was a time when Charlie saw Terry, if not often, often enough to plan a meeting. But that was before he became a persona non grata at Dennis Wilson's pad. And even Charlie knows that's reason enough to squash any possible deal. But then again, maybe not. Charlie did get one of his songs on the new Beach Boys album. Now, true, he didn't get credit for it, but one of the few people who knows it originated from his song, Cease to Exist, is Melcher. So now Terry can legitimately think of Manson as a music composer worthy of producing commercial music, instead of as a shaggy pimp who supplied the record producer with syphilis-ridden jailbait. Now, Terry Melcher had agreed to come out to Spawn Ranch and give Charlie's songs a listen. A date was set, a time was agreed to, an appointment was confirmed, and a whole shindig was put into place at the ranch. Then Terry was a no-show. For Charles Manson to be stood up like that was devastating on a few different fronts. One, Charlie had planned all week for this opportunity to finally perform his music for Terry. The family had decked out and decorated the ranch for this big whoop-de-doo, including practicing with background instruments and half-naked girls harmonizing and dancing in the background. Then Terry didn't show. Also, that was the day.
Charlie was on fire that day. Manson never forgave himself for letting his nerves get the better of him during his one professional recording session. This day would be different. On this day, Charlie was perfectly on point. His mind was calm, his heart was full, and his music was at his fingertips. This day was the day he'd been dreaming about since he first started listening to the Beatles in prison. On this day, all Charlie's dreams would become a reality, and his life would be changed forever. On this day, the music was going to come flooding out of him. He owned his creativity. He couldn't play a wrong note. He was at one with his talent, at one with his muse, and at one with God. Then Terry didn't show. Terry's no-show not only thwarted Manson's creativity and frankly hurt his feelings, but it also compromised him with his kids. The kids at the ranch weren't hip to exactly how much Charlie wanted to be a rock star, how much he wanted fame, money, and recognition, because to them, Charlie preached against those base desires. They thought Charlie was on a spiritual path to enlightenment. They thought Charlie's true desire was to pass on that enlightenment. They thought Charlie's goal was to create a new world order, guided by that enlightenment and love for all mankind. They believed Charlie had a higher purpose, because he told them he did, and they believed him. It never would have occurred to them that he'd ditch all that horseshit in a minute to put on a Revolutionary War outfit and trade places with Mark Lindsay. It would never have occurred to them that he'd say goodbye to all of them, all that he created, all that he taught them, to trade places with Mickey Dolenz and join the Monkees. They thought the only reason Charlie wanted a recording contract in the first place was to expand his influence, to bring his enlightenment to a larger audience, a worldwide audience on a planet starving for it. Like the Beatles, like Jesus Christ, like Charlie. He didn't want fame for himself. He wanted fame for what his music would mean to others. But the music would simply be an entry point for the planet Earth to get to know Charlie. With God working through him, Charlie would write some of the greatest music ever written, the way Jesus Christ wrote some of the greatest poetry ever written. Not to have framed platinum albums on his walls like Dennis Wilson, not to own sports cars like Dennis Wilson, not to be on the cover of Crawdaddy magazine, not to have a song on the Easy Rider soundtrack, not to join the real Don Steele in crazy promotional contests on KHJ, but to save all mankind. Their first glimpse that Charlie's motives and desires may have been less pure than their own was when he couldn't help but reveal his anxiety over the Terry Melcher audition. Everybody wanted everything to go well, but nobody else at the ranch thought everything was riding on it. It goes, it doesn't go. Don't sweat it, baby. What's supposed to happen will happen. Men plan, God laughs. That's what Charlie taught them. So then why was Charlie stressing out so much about what Terry Melcher thought of him? Why was Charlie freaking fucking out about whether or not Terry Melcher liked his music or had a good time? Why was Charlie flipping fucking out, trying to make a good impression on Terry fucking Melcher? But as Terry Melcher's 3:30 appointment turned to 3:40, then 3:50, then 4 o'clock, then 4:10, then 4:20, then 4:30, and it became apparent to all that Terry Melcher wasn't going to show, it became apparent to all how badly Charlie felt. Terry's no-show made Manson look weak in front of his kids. Nothing that took place in front of the family ever made Charlie look weak.
not irate parents, sometimes carrying shotguns, not former members who sometimes came back to the ranch accompanied by friends demanding money, cars, or babies, not the Black Panthers, not even the pigs. Charlie faced them all down with a wink and a smile, secure in the knowledge that God was on his side. But not this time. This time it was Charlie who looked foolish. Something else that day also became apparent. Something the kids at Spawn Ranch had never considered before. Maybe Charlie was just another long-haired hippie with a guitar trying to get on the radio. They couldn't believe it, and they wouldn't believe it. But for the first time, it occurred to some of them. Somehow, Melcher got word to Charlie that he didn't stand him up out of disrespect. He's a busy man, and something important came up. But that was a little while ago. Since then, there's been no effort made to reschedule. And now Charlie and Terry don't run in the same circles. The idea of just bumping into him and setting up another time for another audition doesn't seem likely. In a way, Charlie was getting a good education in what the entertainment business is like. People fall in and out of social circles. Somebody you seriously hung with yesterday rates no more than a wave today. Promising opportunities just don't pan out. Or, as Pauline Kael once wrote, in Hollywood, you could die of encouragement. Well, since Mohammed wasn't going to just bump into the mountain at the Whiskey a Go-Go drinking Cutty Sark, Mohammed would have to go to the mountain, or in this case, the Hollywood Hills. This is Charlie's last card. Since he's been to Terry Melcher's house before, he remembers where he lives. He's even partied there. So him just popping up at his gate to say hi, while bad form, isn't completely out of the question. This is a desperate move, and it feels like a desperate move. And Charlie is pretty fucking sure Terry will read it as a desperate move. But the way things are, it's the only move he has left. Terry had said he'd listen to Charlie's music one day, and Terry did owe him after standing him up before. And Charlie isn't going to just bump into him at Wilson's pad anymore. The only chance Charlie has of rescuing this lost opportunity is lucking out and catching Terry at home and putting the bite on him, a soft bite, just enough to make him feel too guilty to say no to Charlie's face. But without the bite, Charlie's never going to see Terry again. And when this doesn't work, which it probably won't, at least Charlie can say he tried. When Charlie pulls up to the front of Terry's house on Cielo Drive, he sees the gate is open. These people leave their gates open most days. They have a lot of deliveries, so they don't have to keep running to the intercom to buzz people in. Charlie had thought he'd get the brush off at the call box speaker located on the metal pole next to the driveway outside the front gate.
Hi, is Terry there?
Who's asking?
It's his friend, Charlie.
Charlie who?
Charlie Manson.
He ain't here. That's how Charlie imagined the conversation would go, even if it was Terry at the intercom, pretending to be somebody who worked for him. So the gate being open counts as a stroke of luck. Some say luck is when preparation meets opportunity. The preparation part is picking Saturday, late morning, early afternoon, to pay his visit. If he's going to catch Terry bopping around his house, it's going to be Saturday, late morning, early afternoon. Who knows, he might get face-to-face with the man yet. He considers driving the Twinkie truck up the long, curvy driveway, but that's way too bold. Better to be humble. Approach the house on foot, with open palms and a big smile. Leave a soft footprint. Charlie climbs out of the bakery truck. Terry lives on top of a hill at the end of a cul-de-sac. The only other human in sight is a blonde guy with his shirt off working on an antenna on the roof of the house next door. Charlie pays him no mind as he walks up the driveway toward Terry's front door. Sharon places the phonograph needle on the first track
of the Paul Revere and the Raiders album, The Spirit of 67. The creator of the band and the producer of the album used to rent the house on Cielo Drive that Sharon and Roman are now renting from the owner, Rudy Ottobelli, who lives in the guest house out back by the swimming pool. When the former tenant, Terry Melcher, moved out, he was living with the actress, Candice Bergen. But before Candy moved in, Terry shared the pad with Raiders lead singer, Mark Lindsay. So it makes sense Sharon found a whole stack of cellophane-covered copies of The Spirit of 67 tucked away in the guest room closet. She mentioned finding the records to her husband, Roman, who made a face and said, "I hate that bubblegum garbage." Sharon didn't argue, but she didn't agree either. She liked the bubblegum hits she heard on KHJ. She liked that song, Yummy, 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 and the follow-up song by the same group, Chewy Chewy. She liked Bobby Sherman and that Julie song. She loved that Snoopy versus the Red Baron song. She wouldn't tell this to Roman or any of their hip friends like John and Michelle Phillips or Cass Elliott or Warren Beatty, but to be completely honest, she liked the Monkees more than the Beatles. She knows they're not even a real group. They're just a TV show made to capitalize on the popularity of the Beatles. Nevertheless, in her heart of hearts, she prefers them. She thinks Davy Jones is cuter than Paul McCartney, as evidenced by her attraction to Roman and Jay. Sharon does have a thing for cute short guys who look like 12-year-old boys. She thinks Mickey Dolenz is funnier than Ringo Starr. She's more attracted to Mike Nesmith's Quiet One than to George Harrison. And Peter Tork seems just as much of a hippie as John Lennon, but less pretentious, and probably a nicer fellow. Yeah, sure, the Beatles write all their own music, but what the fuck does Sharon care about that? She likes Last Train to Clarksville better than A Day in the Life. She likes it better. She doesn't care who wrote it. Anyway, Paul Revere and the Raiders are sort of like the Monkees. They sing catchy, groovy songs, they're funny, and they're on TV all the time. She really likes their songs, Kicks, Hungry, and especially Good Thing. Rudy Ottobelli told her Mark Lindsay and Terry Melcher wrote Good Thing on the white piano in their living room. Cool, she thinks about that as she places the needle on the vinyl and listens to the cool opening guitar riff come out of her speakers. She starts immediately moving her shoulders and hips to the bubblegum beat. Then she goes back to what she was doing before, which is packing Roman's suitcase. Roman's leaving for London tomorrow, and she always packs his suitcase for him. It's just a sweet thing she started doing for him, and now it's just a sweet thing she does. Her ex-fiancé, Jay Sebring, is in the kitchen making himself a sandwich before he drives Sharon over to his salon on Fairfax and does her hair for a TV appearance Roman and Sharon have to do tonight. Jay exclusively does men's hair. Sharon is the only woman he does. They all attended a party at Hugh Hefner's Playboy Mansion last night. And during the night, Hefner hit up Roman to appear on his quasi-talk show Playboy After Dark, filmed on top of the 9000 building toward the end of the Sunset Strip. Sharon was irritated that Roman committed them to two things in a row without consulting her. Not only that, but she's also reading a really good book, Gore Vidal's Mira Breckenridge. And Roman knows she'd rather spend the evening in bed alongside him reading it. Instead, she's going to have to get all dolled up for the second night in a row and do her sexy little me act. Sexy little me is Sharon's self-deprecating nickname for her 60s starlet persona. As she folds the white turtleneck sweater she bought for Roman when they were in Switzerland and places it inside the suitcase laid open on the guest room bed, she doesn't see the shaggy-haired, dark little hippie fellow in the long, untucked blue denim shirt with the brown rawhide vest over it. The Jesus sandals and the dirty dungarees emerge from her foliage and walk into the cement parking area in front of her house. But Jay spots him through the kitchen window as he takes a bite of his Wonder Bread turkey and tomato sandwich. As Jay follows with his eyes the dark little hippie's path from the driveway to the front of the house, he thinks, who's this shaggy asshole walking around the property as if he owns it? Sharon, packing at the far end of the house, hears Jay's voice by the front door say to somebody authoritatively,
Hello? Can I help you?
Then from outside the house, she hears a muffled answer from a voice she isn't familiar with.
Yeah. Hey, man. I'm looking for Terry. I'm a friend of Terry and Dennis Wilson's.
Who the hell is that, she thinks, keeping her ears peeled. Then she hears Jay's response to the stranger.
Well, Terry and Candy don't live here anymore. This is the Polanski residence now.
Sharon puts down the paisley shirt she's holding and leaves the guest bedroom to investigate who Jay's talking to. As she walks through the carpeted hallway leading to the living room, in bare feet and Levi's cutoffs, she hears the stranger say with surprise and disappointment,
Really? He moved? Dang it! You know where?
Sharon turns the corner leading to the entry hall, with the fearless vampire killer's one sheet framed on the wall. Roman thought it was embarrassing and juvenile to hang up in their house the posters for movies they'd done. But then Sharon reminded him he knew she was embarrassing and juvenile when he married her. The front door is wide open, and Jay has moved outside to talk with this creepy-looking dude with a mop of shaggy hair and a 2-day growth of dark stubble on his face. She reaches the door and calls out to her former fiancé,
Who is it, Jay?
The shaggy-haired stranger's eyes rise to the beautiful blonde in the doorway. Her radiant eyes look past Jay's for a moment to lock with the dark little man's. Jay turns toward her and says, It's okay, honey, it's a friend of Terry's. Then he turns back to the shaggy-haired stranger and directs him to where the owner of the house lives.
I'm not sure where Terry moved to, but the owner of the property, Rudy, might know. He's in the guest house.
With his hand, Jay points the way. Take the back path. The shaggy stranger smiles and says, Thank you kindly. As he turns to leave, he lifts his eyes again to the golden blonde in the doorway, with the long legs, wearing a striped t-shirt that looks like she bought it in the little boys' section of a department store. His hand rises in a wave gesture, and he says, Ma'am? Even though she finds this dark little intruder creepy, she nods at him and returns a slight smile. As the little man makes his way around the back of the property, Sharon's eyes follow him until he disappears from view. Rudy Altobelli has just stepped out of his shower when he hears his dog Bandit pitching a bitch at somebody by his open front door. He knows it's a somebody rather than a something, because when it comes to intruders intruding on the property, the dog has 3 distinct barks. Cats get 1 bark. Lizards, raccoons, and other varmints get another. And humans the dog doesn't know get a 3rd. Rudy throws a towel on top of his head, puts his naked, still wet body in a terry cloth bathrobe, and steps out of his bathroom, heading toward the front door to investigate. Altobelli is a small-time Hollywood manager who, once upon a time, represented